And this is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and myself, Mimi Rosenberg. And we talk with Herb Boyd, author of Black Detroit, A People's History of Self-Determination, a book that chronicles the history of African Americans in Detroit. Multi-Grammy winner and Queen of Soul, Aretha Franklin. Well, she's known for such hits as Respect. Aretha came up with her family from Tennessee to Detroit as part of the Great Migration out of the South of African Americans to the North. And in Detroit, she began her career as a child singing gospel at her father's church, the minister C.L. Franklin in Detroit. And in 1985, Aretha's voice was declared a Michigan natural resource, a Detroit natural resource. Well, Sister Franklin helps us get into the spirit of Detroit, which we will momentarily delve into with author Herb Boyd's Black Detroit, A People's History of Self-Determination. But first, to provide a bit more ambiance for our discussion with Herb Boyd, let's listen to General Baker, a co-founder of the Dodge Revolutionary Union Movement, DRUM, and the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, straight out of Detroit.
Let me tell you, I'm homegrown. I was born here in Detroit in September the 6th, 1941. Let me just say this. The Detroit Rebellion in 1967 is a defining moment in this city's history. I, at that time, was working at the Dodge main plant. We were working 12 hours, 7 days a week. I didn't get off work on the afternoon shift till 3 a.m. in the morning. And everybody that got off with me went to various blind pigs all over the city. It was part of our life. So when the rebellion broke out, about 6 o'clock that morning on 12th Street in Claremont, I was right there, Johnny, on the spot. I was living three blocks from there on Gladstone. After the police came and tried to raid the blind pig, they were surrounded by about 100 workers on the street that started throwing bricks at the police. I was arrested on the first night for violation of curfew and did 15 days in Ionia State Penitentiary waiting to come back to trial. It's a lot of characteristics of the Detroit Rebellion that was different than other rebellions. First of all, everybody proclaims that the Detroit Rebellion was integrated. First person killed in the Detroit Rebellion was a white worker that was looting a store down on Trumbull. When they carried me to Ionia, I had two white guys on my bus that was arrested for sniping. Secondly, the Detroit Rebellion is the only one that had an assassination that took place during the course of the rebellion, and that's the Algiers Motel incident that no longer exists. First thing they did was rename it to the Desert Inn, and that lasted a few years, and now it closed it. And when you get to Virginia Park and Woodward, it's a gated community with a brick wall there, and the Algiers Motel have been wiped off the pages of history. And when you go to the school systems in the city, you can't find the book, the Algiers Motel incident, because they don't want kids to know about it. The other factor of Detroit Rebellion that made it different was they arrested so many people. They arrested over 7,000 people during the Detroit Rebellion. They sent us to Marquette, Milan, Jackson, up with me at Ionia. They fill up all the prison systems in the state. And when they was finished with that, they sent the rest of the people to Belle Isle. So when you talk about Belle Isle as a place for lecture, it became a jail. We called it Belcatraz. The other factor I think is important to know that those National Guard shot up this city. Anybody that went into the rebellion that didn't hate the police had to hate them when the rebellion was over. They shot over 150,000 rounds of ammunition with those 50 caliber machine guns over the city. They had so many shell casings laying on the ground that we picked up the empty 50 caliber machine gun shells, put rawhide on them, and wore them for necklaces as a symbol to the rebellion. I don't know if any of y'all remember that. But the biggest lesson that we learned out of rebellion was that when they established curfew, if you got sick, you couldn't go to the hospital. If you got hungry, you couldn't go to get no food. But if you had a badge from Chrysler, Ford, or General Motors, you'd get through the police line, the National Guard line, and the Army line to take your butt to work. We learned a fundamental lesson out of that, that the only place that black people had any value in the society was at the point of production. And that's why we turn our efforts towards organizing in the factory. And within a year's time after the Detroit Rebellion, Drum was born. And that was the basis of our struggle and the drum movement that grew out of that. The stress I wanted to make was where the struggle to organize the workers came from. It grew out of the rebellion. We learned a fundamental lesson, took that lesson, applied it, and was victorious with it for a while.
Because that was the summer of 67, and usually Herb Boyd excites and stimulates and makes me even madder at the systemic inequities that he reveals as a journalist for the Amsterdam News. But when he pens one of his numerous books, like his most recent, Black Detroit, A People's History of Self-Determination, he takes me on a breathtaking odyssey through the most intimate moments of a people's quest to survive, to liberate, and accomplish self-determination by an indomitable spirit, a magnificent cultural expression, intellectual depth, and humanity. And I want to start that odyssey going back to that clip from General Baker, who started the Detroit Revolutionary Union movement, which influenced, you see, it was Detroit, and it was the General Bakers, and it was the black workers of the Dodge plants and so on that influenced movements of rebellion around the country. Herb, it is good to have you with us.
Thank you, Mimi.
So let's begin with the rebellions
okay.
in Detroit and with people like Baker who are part of your odyssey that you depict for us in your very, very important book.
Let's go back to kind of append a few more comments and observations about the Dodge Revolutionary Union movement and subsequently the League of Revolutionary Black Workers. First of all, I worked at Dodge, Maine myself. I left 2 years before the rebellion. After Malcolm's assassination in February 21st of 1965, you know, I had already left the plant with the intentions of coming to New York and reuniting with Malcolm, because I was with Malcolm before I went into the service in 1962. I was in the Army from 1962 to 1965. And when I came out in January of 65, I got a job at Dodge, Maine. So I worked there for about a month and a half. And then when Malcolm was assassinated, you know, that pretty much ended my dream of coming to New York. And I went to Wayne State University in the fall of 1965. But while I was at Dodge, Maine, I was able to connect with a number of the workers there, including General and Chuck Wooten and Ron March, all of them who were part of the whole origin, the seminal aspects of the Dodge Revolutionary Union movement, because it was a wildcat strike. General didn't get into specifying all of the reasons for the uprise of black workers in those plants, because for us, UAW meant you ain't white. And the rank and file, we figured we just was not being represented properly by the union. And so a wildcat strike ensued, And one of the reasons for that was that the assembly line was going, you know, absolutely ridiculously fast. It was inhuman, 73 cars an hour. I did just about every job at Dodge Main because when someone didn't show up to work, I was a swing man and I had to do their job. Consequently, I worked all over the plant. One of the toughest jobs I had was in the wet deck where you take the prime off, you know, with a buffer. After a while, your hand just cramp up, and your filaments of paint are flying into your skin. I got a skin infection as a result of working on the wet deck. So I knew exactly, you know, some of the horrendous aspects of working at Dodge Main that led to the workers' revolt there. And then later on, when I got to Wayne State University, I was in a position because the 67 Rebellion, we used that as a wedge that we had to hold the university hostage. We kind of intimidated the administration there and began to make demands in terms of black studies, because this is a period of time, about a year before, black studies really got the kind of critical mass in 1968. So we were like right in the beginning at Wayne State University, students there, because many of them had worked in the various plants around the cities who were lucky enough to get into Wayne State University, because so that was one of the demands that we made, is that we needed an increased enrollment of African-American students at Wayne State University, because here's a university that's located right in the heart of the black community, but we're not represented on campus. So when the rebellion broke out in the fall of 1967, I was a part of those students who began to make demands on the administration, have black studies and classes of African-American experience included in the curriculums, that we have an increased enrollment of African-American students on campus. And as a result of that, I ended up teaching the first classes in African-American studies at Wayne State University. And I was in a position then to facilitate the arrival of many of my former workers at Dodge Main, then became students at Wayne State University. It's a really, it's a story I get into in a very extensive way, you know, inside of the book Black Detroit, because Wayne State University, of course, was a hotbed of political activism. But after a while, you know, with the whole inclusion, this here invasion of young blacks, you know, coming on campus, we had the kind of army there to begin to make those demands reality to those demands. And so the administration surrendered and began to give us what we want. But the 67 Rebellion was important because it provided us with the kind of a threat that we could bring, that the possibility, the potentiality of that uprising breaking out on campus was a very real thing.
Your book seems to me to be, it's an odyssey. It's a personal odyssey. It's a personal odyssey that takes place within Detroit. And I was thinking as I was reading the book that, you know, surely Detroit must have been the capital of 20th century African America, as you, native son Herb Boyd, recounts the centrality of a number of dates and events. I mean, you go back to look at from the American Revolution, for example, how pronounced issues of the Underground Railroad, of the black abolitionists, and the stories that are within the book, are just kind of see this as an odyssey from one experience in one period to the other. But made me think of Detroit as the capital of 20th century Africa, African-American life.
You're absolutely right. The centrality of Detroit, kind of a microcosm in terms of the story of the black experience in America. One of the reasons is because if you go back to the beginning of the 18th century, because Detroit was founded in 1701, French explorer Cadillac, he arrived there and established Fort Pontchartrain. He had this here vision of building this city, this fort here. And, of course, the indigenous population, we can't forget the Miami and the Ottawa, these Native American populations that resided around here that had to be really tamed, if not destroyed, these conquistadores who came in. But anyway, what happened with that is that slavery, by 1736, we have the real introduction of African American slaves Indian slaves also existed at the same time. They call them either the Pawnees or the Pawnees. But nonetheless, they all were captives, and they were held in bondage. And a lot of people don't know about slavery existing in Detroit. In the same way, it existed in New York City. As a matter of fact, New York City at one time had more slaves than in Charleston, South Carolina. There were more than 100 slaves in Detroit in 1840. And that's where it prompted the rise of the abolitionist movement in the city. And it was led some very formidable individuals like William Lambert and George D. Baptiste, William Webb, Madison Lightfoot, these individuals who were part of the Underground Railroad. In fact, William Lambert, they said that, and maybe a bit of an exaggeration, that he some 40,000 individuals passed through his embrace. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Detroit is located right across the river from Windsor, Canada. So by 1850, which you had a Fugitive Slave Act, that means you had to go a little bit further because the bounty hunters were on the wild, and they would just abduct. They would grab people, black people off the street, whether they had their papers or not, with the whole idea of taking them back to the plantation to get even a more of a reward in terms of the bounty. So here's these black abolitionists, and they were just so absolutely creative, so inventive. They put together what they call the African-American Mysteries, which was the Order of Men of Oppression, which they used all kind of secret codes and passwords and handshakes to ensure the safe passage of these runaways, these fugitives from the plantation. Well, in 1833, we had the first major riot in the city of Detroit. So what I do in Black Detroit, though, is I begin to center the city, you know, as being this here kind of repository, this here archives of our history as they arrived in the city. You're beginning with the slave period, right on down through the 1860s with the Civil War, because we had like a major riot in Detroit in 1863, similar to the draft riots that occurred in New York City. Mm-hmm. In other words, throughout the book, I try to draw some parallels between what's happening in Detroit and other cities around the country. So if you get beyond the slave period and into the whole migration, and in the 1920s, when Henry Ford made that $5 a day offer, again, Detroit is pivotal because, you know, if you look at Alabama, for example, my mother arrived in Detroit. She was 21 years old when she arrived in Detroit in 1941. You go back and look at William Lambert. When he arrived in Detroit, he was 21. And back in 1838, when he arrived in Detroit, he was 21 years old. So you have this here kind of young people who arrived in the city because they were attracted for a number of reasons. Of course, a labor question and working in Henry Ford's plants, that was going to be like a major inducement for a number of people to kind of pack it up and get out of Mississippi, Georgia, and Alabama, running away from Jim Crow, the Ku Klux Klan, the boll weevil, and looking beyond the cotton curtain, you know, into the so-called promised land.
The history of the trials and tribulations, the history of racial oppression, which punctuates all of the book. But while it does that, there is always the sense of uplift and the enormous creativity and coming together of Black Lives Matter in the most extremely exciting way. And so we can't not mention Motown. For sure, but I'm going to back into it through one of my favorite musicians, Yusef Lateef, The World of Jazz. And that's also a very vibrant and real part of the book, the cultural expression of Black life in Detroit.
You're absolutely right in terms of the kind of cultural, but also the dance, the theater, the literature, when you start talking about the evolution of African-American publishing, for example. One of the seminal moments is Broadside Press that was established by Dudley Randall in Detroit. You know, one of the things I do, and of course the music is so important for me, particularly Yusef Lateef, since I worked with him on his book, The Gentle Giant, his autobiography. And I just recently returned from, last Saturday, I was at the funeral out in Newark, you know, for Jerry Allen, just a phenomenal musician who... I've met her when she was 16, 17 years of age, fresh out of Cass Tech, and she hooked up with a number of the music organizations that I was affiliated with including the Jazz Development Workshop and the Metro Arts Complex and the Detroit Jazz Center and the whole Strata Concert Gallery, all of those different kind of musical developments around jazz. You know, I was involved with it right from the beginning. Jazz Research Institute, I started that and was housed it at the Wayne State University when I was running the Black Studies program there. So jazz is always important in my life, you know, all the way back to the 1920s when you had McKinney's Cotton Pickers there. So one of the things when people say Detroit, first thing out of their mouth, talk about Motown and the whole genius of Berry Gordy back in 1958-59 when he put together Motown Records, he just plucked from the kind of reservoir of talent that existed in the city. And I grew up with a lot of those individuals, went to intermediate and elementary and high school, you know, with people who became, you know, the great stars, the Temptations, the Four Tops, the songwriters like Brian and Eddie Holland, Lamont Dozier. Because I lived in the Jeffries Project, you know, right across the hall from Smokey Robinson's cousin. So whenever Smokey and Claudette and Pete and them would show up to do their rehearsals, the doors would be wide open so I could just kind of move right on in there and be a participant. My whole music interest was developed as a result of these close associations, the kind of fortuitous opportunities I had to be in so many different places. My mother was moving every two or three years we seemed to be moving. So consequently, I grew up all over the city and had opportunities to be in touch with so many different aspects, you know, of the city's political, social, cultural, economic development. When you go back to the 1960s when the music is just bustling in Detroit, it's like a cauldron, you know, of musicians who could be members of almost every major ensemble. In the 1965 to about 1970, you could not look at a major ensemble, orchestra, band, quartet, quintet, quartet that did not have an African-American musician in the membership. I mean, if you look at the great, you know, formations that Miles Davis had, for example, the bass player there was Paul Chambers. You know, and on and on, you know, for whether you had, like, Yusef Lateef had around him mostly Detroit musicians who went on to greater fame and fortune. So Detroit, you know, fed the music industry in the same way that we fed, you know, the automobile industry. So we were at the point of production, as General Baker talked about. You know, some of those workers in the plants were also musicians by night if they had were working on the day on a day shift. And if they were working on a midnight shift, you know, as I was, they had other opportunities to do it in the daytime and working at other cultural organizations, you know, writing their poetry. I remember Ron Milner. I grew up with him, a very fine playwright. You know, he went to Northeastern High School, kind of my rival because I was at Northwestern High School. And so you had this athletic thing also in Detroit. It was very, very competitive, and particularly Cass Tech and Northwestern, it was in Miller High School. So all of this here, I talk about, you know, the education, the whole history of education in Detroit. Again, we were pivotal because some of the first public school systems of any real impact and significance came out of Detroit, you know, going all the way back to the 1840s, 1850s, with Fannie Richards, who was the first African-American teacher and to integrate Detroit public school system. So we see seminal moments, you know, the arsenal of democracy. Detroit, again, is right in the center in terms of the war machine that was developed. My mother, again, not so much a Rosie DeRiveter, but she worked in the various plants because there was opportunities for women to get to jobs because a young man was being drafted, conscripted to go off and fight in a war. So it opened up opportunities for women to work in the plants. But as soon as the war was over, then they were dispatched back to either the housewives or, if they, like my mother, was a domestic servant, she ended up going back doing housework in the suburbs of Detroit, which she did all of her life, and her story is a part of the book, though, Mimi. And if you have a closer reading of it, you know, people would discover exactly who she was, because she was at all of these very important moments in Detroit's history, the whole migration, the second migration in the 1940s. She was a part of that. And when the whole war broke out again, she was a part of the arsenal of democracy. And we had major incidents of the police brutality in the city, the killing of Cynthia Scott. She lived right upstairs over us in 1963 when she was killed. We knew her very well. We called her Bebe back then. And that stimulated a lot of activity. Members of Uhuru, which is Swahili word for freedom, and also who were connected later on, would be connected to the Dodge Revolutionary Union Movement, the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, had begun to kind of cut their eye teeth on struggle going back to the 1962-63 period when we had a lot of social political activism in the city. So Detroit is like, you know, kind of key to understanding the Odyssey, the whole struggle of self-determination by the black people in America.
Your book is the story of Detroit, but it's the story of the black odyssey of racism and oppression and the habitual overcoming to build and enhance whatever environment people of African descent find themselves in. Well, I will tell you that, you know, I will go back to, which is still part of your odyssey on the African-American experience and how anybody that reads about it from your perspective will be so enriched. Herb has taught black studies for at least 30 years at various...
almost 50 now.
Almost 50, am I behind on that. He's an extraordinary, facile, comprehensive writer. The prose just seeps into your soul, literally and figuratively. And I must encourage all of you to read Herb Boyd's Detroit, A People's History of Self-Determination, and it is a people's history of self-determination. If you care about the quest for democracy and a people's efforts to establish it, for all people to stand on the shoulders of those who have fought the most diligently and comprehensively for it, this is the book for you. Herb Boyd's Detroit, A People's History of Self-Determination, and thank you for gracing us with your presence.
Well, the pleasure was all mine.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.